This is AENN, American Exceptionalism News Network.
2-1-1-0. The bottom line is something's up.
Now, I realize it's fashionable in some circles to believe that no one in government should encourage others to read the Bible. That we're told that we'll violate the constitutional separation of church and state established by the Founding Fathers in the First Amendment. The First Amendment was not written to protect people and their laws from religious values. It was written to protect those values from government tyranny.
1-1-0.
Yes, this was in a book for Freemasons. Fictions are necessary to the people, and the truth becomes deadly to those who are not strong enough to contemplate it in all its brilliance. In fact, what can there be in common between the vile multitude and sublime wisdom? The truth must be kept secret, and the masses need a teaching proportional to their imperfect reason.
Broadcasting live from a bunker high atop Mount Hood.
All heading towards a fascist totalitarian state.
It's radio that's delivering the truth.
AK-47s belong in the hands of soldiers, not in the hands of criminals.
See, the problem is they don't get to determine what is right and wrong in the process. It's all done by the central government.
And here's Paul Preston and Agenda 21 Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to Agenda 21 Radio. This is the radio show that is stopping totalitarianism one person at a time. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, the totalitarians, they are on the march. And, you know, very few times in world history are we seeing what we're seeing right now from our world leaders and what's going on in the world. And those of you that are in denial that certain forces are out there that are very sinister forces, well, hopefully by the end of this hour, you're going to be convinced otherwise, because with us on the radio right now is Peter Lavenda, author of so many books about, well, I guess you would say the occult, but also about Nazism and Adolf Hitler, and a couple of books that I find very interesting, The Rat Line, and also his latest book, The Hitler Legacy. Peter, welcome back to Agenda 21 Radio.
Many thanks. Good to be here.
Well, boy, it's been quite a journey for you. You started years and years and years ago tracking the occult movement of Hitler and the Germans and people that most people would just not want to remember in history. But thank goodness that you're bringing them back to life, because things are happening in this world today as a direct result of what happened 40, 50, 60 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. That's been that's one of the realizations I came to, you know, as I went along. I mean, I started this journey back during the old, good old Watergate days, and, you know, a lot's changed since then, but the more things change, the more they stay the same. I mean, it's a lot of the things I was researching back in the 70s that people thought I was even crazy to be considering it have since all turned out pretty much the way I thought they would. I was afraid they would, and we're reaping the whirlwind right now.
Well, let's get into... I guess we just need to dive right into the conversation, because I've been getting so many requests, because I go and speak publicly and I talk about Adolf Hitler and my visit to the Führer bunker in 1992, and I bring you up and the story about I heard you on Coast to Coast, and boy, I popped right out of bed because I can remember a guy by the name I know. Well, I knew his name because I wrote it down in the book. His name was Christoph Neubauer, who was standing there on the Führer bunker trying to protect and preserve, actually, the Führer bunker as a historical preservationist. And I know that he was featured in one of the History Channel's movies or programs that basically debunked the notion that Hitler died in the Führer bunker. And, boy, when I found that out and then I started realizing what you were talking about, it was matching up with my own research, I was pretty much stunned, because I can remember the words that he said at the time, that Hitler did not die in the bunker. He got away. And yeah, I thought he was crazy.
Exactly. I mean, if anybody had told that to me 20 years ago, my reaction would have been the same. I mean, I grew up, it was a doctrine, it was a matter of faith. Hitler committed suicide in the bunker on April 30th, 1945. That's it, end of story, move along, you know. And there was no reason to doubt it, according, you know, to my tender imagination. I mean, if a bunch of adults who had fought in World War II, and I had uncles, all of my uncles fought in the war, and they came to, you know, they were saying Hitler committed suicide and died in the bunker, who was I to disagree? Who was I to doubt it? It just seemed like an article of faith. And then slowly but surely, you know, and reluctantly in my case, I came to the realization that we really don't have any proof he died in the bunker or died at all, for that matter. There's no forensic evidence to show this. There's no, I mean, the eyewitness testimony is all over the place, and it's by SS officers, right? So what possible motivation could they have for making stuff up, right?
What could possibly go wrong with their interpretation of events?
Exactly, especially since they were all at odds with each other. None of them were consistent. All of these guys had the story of Hitler dying in the bunker, sometimes not even committing suicide. In one case, one of the SS officers said he was shot by one of the other officers there. I mean, there's been so many different stories about it. And the prisoners the Russians had kept changing their story. And the prisoners the Brits had changed theirs. And our prisoners changed ours. And the whole thing became a circus. And I didn't realize this until, maybe 2008, 2009, something like that, when suddenly all of these pieces started to fit together. And I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, I can't believe this. You know, this can't be true, that he might have escaped after all. And it does seem that, you know, there's sufficient evidence to really look at all this again and say, yeah, we have to accept the fact that he might have or probably escaped.
Well, you know, I was talking the other day on the radio. I've actually mentioned this many, many times, and I know that in your new book, The Hitler Legacy, you really do bring a lot of this out. And I'm really glad this is the most recent book that you've written about this, because people need to get this, because it really explains so much that's happening today. But I was saying to people, do you realize that Hitler did, in fact, I just would play the scenario out. If, in fact, he did survive, you know, what would he do for the rest of his life? And I said, you know, he would have enormous impact upon this planet. And I think that's pretty much what he's done, isn't it?
Well, from my point of view, yes. I mean, let's posit that he escaped. As you say, what would he be doing? He was a charismatic leader of an entire movement. He gave that movement its name, its symbol, the swastika. He gave it, you know, so much of the character that we understand of Nazism today. He virtually single-handedly created it. And if he suddenly dropped out of sight, it was not to, you know, retire and start growing tulips somewhere. You know, this was to keep the fight going. And not just him, but he had a cadre of people who were true believers, who were never in a million years going to give up the dream of the Third Reich. It just wasn't going to happen. So they were going to continue the war by other means. They were going to switch their theater of operations from Europe to other places around the world, including especially the Middle East, but also Latin America and other places. And they were going to continue the fight. These were true believers. And I make the analogy sometimes. People may find it distasteful, but take a look at it and see if you might not agree. Christianity was oppressed for over 350 years, more or less, until Constantine, you know, made it a state religion. Until that time, they were meeting in cemeteries, they were meeting in catacombs, they were oppressed, they were being killed. They kept that belief alive for more than 300 years under extreme oppression by state governments around the world, in their world. Now we have another kind of faith, you might say. It's a kind of a satanic faith, and it's based upon all sorts of things we may find distasteful today, like racial superiority, as an example, but a lot of other ideas, too, like extreme nationalism, on and on and on. These guys were true believers, especially the SS. These were people who really believed 100% that what they were doing was right, and the ones that escaped, the SS officers that escaped, that went all over the world, to Latin America, to the Middle East, to Asia, these were people who, when they were interviewed much later on, 20 years later, 30 years later, 40 years later, they were still expressing the same ideas, the same beliefs, and kept saying what they had done was the right thing. So when you have that body of personnel, of true believers scattered around the world, indoctrinating new cadres, spreading the word, I mean, making sure that Mein Kampf is constantly being translated into different languages. I have a lot of different translations of Mein Kampf. I mean, in languages some people haven't even heard of, you know, and this propaganda effort's been going on since 1945.
Well, you know, I do know, and I think that you confirmed it, that the largest selling book in the Middle East is Mein Kampf.
That's exactly true. And second to that is Henry Ford's The International Jew.
There you go. So, so let's talk a little bit about the rat line itself and where all that came from your standpoint, because the book is an incredible book. It's called The Rat Line, Soviet Spies, Nazi Priests, and the Disappearance of Adolf Hitler. And this was, I think, published, or you came out in 2011, 2012. Is that what it was?
When you're 2012.
On, 2012, you were on George Norrie. I couldn't believe I sat right up in the chair, in the bed, and I said, wait a minute, I know what's going on here. And that's when we got in touch and we put you on the air, and you've been on. This is, I think, the third time now on Agenda 21 Radio. Welcome to your world, I think is what you said to me at one point. Okay, right. Here I am. Anyway, so the situation, though, and again, we can kind of go through the whole thing about, you know, how he escaped and all that. I'm not really concerned about that. I'm more concerned about when he escaped, where did he go initially? And I think you pretty much document that he went to Argentina. He ended up in Argentina, which is, seems to be what they're following on the History Channel right now with their programs that they have out about hunting Hitler.
Yeah, I have more information on that. I can update this a little bit since then, because I have since gone back to Asia to do more research. I was contacted by someone there who had a lot of original documentation about the presence of Nazis in Southeast Asia, including some very important documentation, a diary, basically, an address book, a list of names of contacts and everything else. This is a very strange story. I was of the opinion that had Hitler escaped to Argentina, I didn't believe he would have stayed there very long. I think one of the reasons is he was betrayed. Hitler was betrayed by a lot of his personnel after the D-Day invasions in July of June and July of 44. There was the attempt on his life in July of 44, Operation Valkyrie.
Correct.
Himmler was trying to cut a side deal. All the rats were trying to cut, you know, deals to protect themselves and their assets. And I think that Hitler began to distrust everyone, which is why he dropped out of sight. He wasn't actually seen in public, I think, for the rest of 1944, if I'm not mistaken. And there was one sighting or two in 45, but we're not sure if that was Hitler or one of his several doubles. As we found out later on, he had at least two doubles that we know of. We know their names and we know their what happened to them. One of them died in the vicinity of the bunker. The Soviet troops had found him.
Mm-hmm.
Another one had fled and was living in another city, and they found him as well. So we know there were doubles. You know, we know a lot of other information about Hitler and the possibility of his escape. But I think if he had gone to Argentina, remember, Eichmann was snatched in 1960. You had Mossad agents all over the place looking for Nazis in general, for war criminals. Eisenhower was of two minds as to whether Hitler had died in the bunker or not. J. Edgar Hoover maintained active files on Hitler searches for more than a decade after the war, about 20 years after the war. Hoover himself didn't believe that Hitler had died in the bunker either, and he was actively soliciting information from his contacts in South America as to that situation. So I believe at this point, and I'm putting together the information that I have from other sources, that Hitler may very well have gone to South America the way the History Channel is discussing it. But I don't believe he stayed there. I don't believe he would have spent that much time in South America. I think he felt he was in too much danger there.
Mm-hmm.
The Israelis were everywhere. American intelligence was giving some degree of cover to a number of refugees, war criminals, really, Klaus Barbie being the most famous. But they wouldn't have given that much cover to Hitler at that time if they thought you know, revealing his whereabouts would have exposed an American intelligence operation. I believe, and I'm saying believe as opposed to know at this point, but I believe that Hitler would have kept on going.
Mm-hmm.
And the information that I have is that he wound up in Southeast Asia, specifically in Indonesia, where there was a large believe it or not, a large Nazi presence before the war and during the war, as well as after the war. There was a series of Nazi cells in most of the major cities of Indonesia that were set up in the 1930s by one of Hitler's closest friends, by a man called Walter Havel. Walter Havel marched with Hitler during the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923. He was a teenager at that point, but he was imprisoned along with Hitler, along with Hess and some of the others. He was released after about a year. He went to the UK for a short period of time, and then from there, he wound up in Indonesia for 10 solid years. And as he was in Indonesia, he set up Nazi party offices in Jakarta and all the major cities of Indonesia. When Hitler came to power in 1933, Walter Havel was eventually called back, and he was one of the last people to leave the Berlin bunker alive in the first days of May 1945. He stayed next to Hitler during this entire time, and he was full of stories about Indonesia, so much so they used to call him Surabaya Wally. Surabaya is a big city. Yeah, Surabaya is a big city in Indonesia. He spent a lot of time up there. It's a port city in the northern part of Java. And they called him Surabaya Wally, and they loved listening to his stories. And this is all documented. This is not stuff that's come to me, you know, circuitously or anything. This is information you can find pretty much readily in histories of the period. So Walter Havel was there. He was in the bunker when supposedly Hitler had died. And then he disappears in May of 45. He's never been seen again. No one knows what happened to him. So I started putting two and two together. Also the fact that Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister, was known to have had Indonesian ancestors. One of his grandparents was Javanese. They used to make fun of him, saying that he wasn't a full-blooded Aryan because he had Javanese blood. You know?
Wow.
They say that one of the reasons for his club foot was because of some sort of genetic disorder that he had inherited from his Javanese grandparents. So there's this very weird but very persistent Indonesian connection to the Third Reich and specifically to Hitler.
Well, you know, and of course, the History Channel, I don't know, there's two stories that are going around out there that, and I know Jerome Corsi wrote a book about Hitler. He says Hitler ended up in Argentina and died in Argentina. I had him on the show. I wasn't buying that he died in Argentina because I think, like you were saying and had already told me, and it was very obvious they were hunting Hitler and they were looking for him, and why stay in Argentina when you're being hunted? And even now, they're into the third, I guess tonight's the fourth show, they've been kind of depicting that it looks like Hitler was going to varying state safe houses, if you will, while he was in Argentina, so which would confirm basically what you're saying. It seems to me that they're saying he was on the move. Where's he going to go? And I guess the question is, where are they going to end up with this? And after their series is done about what they're going to say about Hitler. But I want to ask you quickly, because one of the things that's really critical for the rat line to function and to have functioned, or what we would know to have been Odessa at the time, was the Catholic Church and the use of various churches all around the world and monasteries to hide the diaspora, if you will, and it was quite successful.
Well, yeah. I mean, the very first rat line, to use that term, was created by a Roman Catholic Monsignor, Father Draganovic, who was a Croatian priest. The Croatian Ustashi was the Nazi puppet state in the Balkans at the time during World War II. He managed to get all of his people out, the entire government, basically, of Croatia, the Nazi puppet regime, moved to Argentina, as well as their assets. You know, there was tremendous amounts of gold and other valuables that was also being moved through what they call the monastery route. That went through northern Italy and then off the boats to Argentina. The Croatian puppet government was one of the first bunches of Nazi war criminals to arrive in Argentina. But what a lot of people don't realize, and they study this, and you know, there's a huge amount of evidence that the Catholic Church was deeply involved with these guys because they were anti-communist. They saw communism as atheism, as the greater threat to the church and to Christianity. So they put in their lots with the Nazis, who were at least fighting the communists. People like Juan Perón, who was a very devout Catholic and a very devout fascist and anti-communist. The same thing was true of Franco in Spain. So you had this network of Catholics, committed Catholics, who were also committed Nazis. And there were a lot of priests, archbishops, and even cardinals who were actively involved in protecting the Nazis and getting them false papers and false documents to leave Europe and to go to various places around the world. But what a lot of people don't realize is that the Catholic Church was just as strong in places in the Pacific, especially in the Philippines. So you had a very strong Catholic presence in the Philippines. There was a lot of buried gold that the Japanese and the Nazis had dibs on, that was being buried in caves and in mines throughout the Philippines and throughout the Indonesian archipelago and the various islands that were there. So you had a lot of assets, you had a lot of money, you had especially a lot of gold. As was revealed about 10 or 15 years ago, it kind of made a blip in the news and then died off again, was the fact that the Bank of Portugal in Lisbon, after the war, shipped 40 tons of gold to their colony in Asia, Macau, which is now part of China, but which was part of the Portuguese empire at the time. This 40 tons of gold went to Macau. 20 tons of it, we know, went into China somewhere, possibly to prop up the Chiang Kai-shek regime during their fight against Mao Zedong. Another 20 tons of gold went into Indonesia. We know this. This is documented. There's no doubt about it. In the 1980s, I have the newspaper clippings from the Singapore newspapers, the Indonesian newspapers. One of the people who had worked for Sukarno, who was the first president of a free Indonesia after the war, talked about something called the Revolutionary Fund. And he claimed he knew where all that money was. He was in prison because he was part of the Sukarno regime. Sukarno was overthrown in 1965, the famous year of living dangerously. All of his people were thrown in jail. This guy is still in jail all through the 1980s. And he was trying to buy his way out by revealing the existence of the gold and where it was. So we have this, and that leads into the Nazi story that I probably should get into after the break. But it has to do with a bank in Jakarta. It has to do with a Nazi official who was in Indonesia at the time, and with some information that was given to me very helpfully by one of my readers who noticed an anomaly and was able to identify the situation and was able to reveal to me almost accidentally what had happened to the rest of the story of the so-called presence of Hitler in Indonesia, the Revolutionary Fund, gold certificates, and a major scandal.
Well, when we come back, and we're going to come up to a break in about 10 seconds here. We come back, I definitely want to explore this because this is something that's happening, well, affecting us even today, which a lot of people might not understand. But I definitely want to talk about Sukarno and the overthrow there because that was something I think that maybe Mr. Hitler might have been involved with. Anyway, stay with us. More from Peter Lavenda, author of The Rat Line, Soviet Spies and Nazi Priests, here on Agenda 21 Radio.
We're sending out an SOS to the last vestiges of freedom, democracy, and the American way of life. Paul Preston with Agenda 21.
Paid non-attorney spokesperson Adam Pulaski of the Pulaski Law Firm with principal office in Houston, Texas is the attorney responsible for the content of this ad. This ad is not legal advice and the choice of a lawyer should not be based solely upon advertisement. Services may not be available in all states.
Attention Xarelto users. If you or a loved one took Xarelto and suffered a serious bleeding event, you may be entitled to financial compensation. Xarelto is a popular prescription blood thinner used to prevent blood clots and protect patients from strokes. But doctors have recently discovered they are unable to reverse or control serious side effects such as internal bleeding caused by Xarelto. These serious bleeding events have led to numerous cases of hospitalization and even death. Call now if you or a loved one was hospitalized from any form of internal bleeding or stroke after taking Xarelto. You may be entitled to a cash award and substantial financial compensation. Don't be a silent victim. There is limited time to file a claim, so call now. Call 800-296-0773. Phone lines are open 24/7. Call 800-296-0773. That's 800-296-0773. Again, 800-296-0773.
The notion that I can just suspend deportations through executive order, That's just not the case.
Take off the tinfoil hat and put on the Kevlar. It's time for battle. It's Paul Preston at the Agenda 21 Show.
And welcome back to Agenda 21 Radio. And with us is Peter Labenda, author of many, many books about Nazis and finding Adolf Hitler. And the one that he has just recently written is Hitler Legacy. And I'm really glad you've written that book. I haven't read it yet, but I will be tonight. Guaranteed, Peter, I'm going to be definitely reading that one tonight. Because I think, as I recall, before you wrote the book, we were talking about that legacy. You know, having lived, what would the world be like? But I want to go back to this whole thing with Sukarno and Indonesia, and because if in fact Adolf Hitler was there, I can remember the time when I went to when I did go to Germany, and during 1992, and I spoke to a State Department person. And he said to me, he said, "Why do you want to go there?" I said, "It said, well, you know, I'm researching the collapse of communism, yada yada yada." And we talked about going to the East and all that stuff. He says, "You do know that just because the wall fell, just because the Cold War is supposedly over, and just because World War II ended, that these people didn't stop what they're doing. You know, you're still going to have the Stasi who's going to follow you when you go there. You're going to, you know, there's not going to be a lot of people on the street. It's just going to be like it was back in the Cold War." And I said, "Well, that's perfect for me." And boy, he was right. But that's the truth, isn't it? Just because the war ended didn't mean that Hitler stopped what he was doing.
No, I mean, you don't kill an idea with military force, right? If an army loses a war under normal circumstances, well, they lost the war. You know, the other army comes in, they divide up the spoils, and that's it. But we're living in a different age now. We're living in an age of ideological conflict. Communism was an ideology, is an ideology. You're not going to destroy it by killing a lot of Russians, you know. The ideology will still survive. It's the ideology you have to fight. You have to defeat the ideology, showing it to be a fantasy or unworkable, whatever you want to do. But defeating the Wehrmacht during World War II, the German army did not defeat the SS. The SS went underground. The SS was considered to be a criminal organization. So every single member of the SS was liable to be arrested and had to go through a denazification procedure. This essentially created a cult, if it didn't already exist. Mm-hmm. It created a kind of mafia, an underground organization. They were forced underground. And when they went underground, they took their money, and they took their technology, they took their know-how with them, and they were looking for revenge, and they were looking to try to undo what had happened during World War II. They had no illusions that suddenly the world was going to be one big happy family, that the Russian bear, you know, and the American eagle were going to get together and hang out. They knew that wasn't going to happen. And they also knew they were going to do whatever they could to make sure it didn't happen by pitting one side against the other. The Nazis wanted communism to fail, but they wanted us to fail as well. Well, guess what? Phase one already happened.
Yeah, you know? And now they're looking at phase two. And yeah. quite frankly, a lot of people don't recognize who the enemy is out there and what ideology is driving it. But to me, it's pretty obvious. I think it is to you also. But let's talk about Hitler and what he may have been up to. It being in Indonesia, and of course, Sukarno being overthrown in 1965, that, you know, there were a lot of forces that were pitted against him. I know that there was a guy by the name of Hasekarwa, I believe his name is, who was a Nazi war criminal, but he had plundered China, and I know that he was intimately involved with the overthrow of Sukarno. Was Hitler involved?
Well, the Nazis were certainly involved. And in the case that I was researching for Ratline about this very mysterious Austrian man who was living on a remote island in Indonesia, there's a very telling incident from his past, which has been documented as well in a number of places. During 1965, this man who never traveled outside of this island, who was always stayed very remote, very far away from civilization in general, decides to go to the island of Bali. Now, Bali, as everyone knows, is this island paradise. I mean, it's a great place. If you've never been there, you got to go. You know, it's one of these places that's just phenomenally beautiful and restful and gorgeous and everything else. But in 1965, Bali was the scene of a massive crackdown because of the overthrow of Sukarno. We're talking about some numbers have gone as high as over 100,000 people massacred in Bali for being quote-unquote communists or Chinese or sympathizers of the communists or Chinese or something. That's precisely the same time this mysterious Austrian man, posing as a doctor, by the way, on the island where he's living, but he had no medical experience. This doctor winds up in Bali, returns from Bali a short time later, and tells his new wife he had married a Muslim woman because his European bride had basically ditched him, I guess, and gone back to Europe, tells her that he was so happy that the people there remembered him. He didn't mean the Balinese. Yeah. He meant the other Germans and the other Austrians. He was somehow involved in this thing. He would have gone to Indonesia if this is, in fact, Hitler, as many Indonesians claim, that this man who lived on this island was actually Hitler. He bore a striking resemblance to the sort of young, emaciated Hitler we see from the World War I photographs. If this gentleman was Hitler, he would have been deeply involved in the overthrow of Sukarno. Initially, Sukarno was seen as somebody they could work with. Hjalmar Schacht, who was Hitler's finance minister, the guy who basically created the Nazi economic miracle of the 1930s, Hjalmar Schacht had been imprisoned for a short time as a war criminal. The Soviets wanted to kill him. For some reason, we protected him. Schacht then went to Indonesia shortly after Sukarno came to power and tried to convince Sukarno to create essentially an Islamic caliphate that would stretch through all the Muslim countries of Asia as a bulwark against Chinese communism. What was Hjalmar Schacht doing in Indonesia and why was that important to him? You know, this is politically important to him, but also economically. They were moving a lot of assets into Southeast Asia at the time, including, as I mentioned before, a lot of gold. But Sukarno, during World War II, he had made speeches in favor of Hitler. He had praised Hitler. He made speeches in favor of the Japanese. Once the Indonesia was liberated, and he was getting a lot of pressure from the Americans and a lot of pressure from a lot of different people to toe the line, Sukarno decided he would go independent. And Sukarno decided he was going to create a competitor to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund by using all this gold he had suddenly come into possession of after the war, which was Nazi and Japanese gold. And he was going to create this way for third world countries to cooperate with him instead of with the IMF, instead of with the World Bank. So he was creating this sort of division between East and West and becoming independent. Well, they couldn't have that, you know. And so the story started to develop that he was in bed with the Chinese communists, that he was cozying up to China. We tried to overthrow him in the late 1950s. It didn't work. Lee Harvey Oswald, actually, believe it or not, was in the Philippines at the time. He was a Marine. He was stationed in the Philippines. He was going to be ready as one of the people to land in Indonesia should the American invasion get the green light.
Now that is interesting.
Yeah, that is a phenomenal piece of American history. I mean, it's just, it blows the mind. And years ago, I worked with a man who claimed that he was part of that force. He was a submarine officer, a submarine commander, who had actually received a medal from President Kennedy because of his participation in this attempted military coup against Sukarno. But it didn't work back in the late 50s and by 1960. But by 1965, it was a done deal. We had backed Suharto. We had sent planes in. We had sent personnel in. And eventually, Sukarno was overthrown. Suharto took over. He became essentially president for life and didn't leave power until the 1990s, until the time of the Asian economic crisis in 96, 97. So we're talking about, you know, a major readjustment of the political situation in Southeast Asia. At the time, Vietnam is going on, sure. The invasions of Cambodia, Laos, et cetera, all of this is going on at the same time. And members of the Third Reich, Nazi war criminals, were deeply involved in all of this.
What about the Royal Dutch Shell business down there?
Yeah. You know, if you go to Indonesia, there's a couple of companies you're going to hear about right away. Royal Dutch is one of them, Monsanto is another. The copper mines and the the other mining operations that go on in Indonesia, they're all owned by foreigners. They're all controlled by foreigners. The Indonesians are kind of trying to nationalize this, but Sukarno attempted that, and look what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, they're still under foreign operation in most cases. People have rioted. People have been killed to maintain the dominance of Royal Dutch, Monsanto, and some of the other corporations that are operating in Indonesia. You don't notice it so much in the major cities, but when you go out to the islands, when you go out to the rest of the archipelago, you're going to see a massive presence of foreign companies trying to dominate the natural resources of that country. It's the 10th largest country, 10th largest economy in the world. It's the fourth largest country in terms of population, and it's the largest Muslim country in the world.
Right. A lot of people don't know that. One of the things that comes up is we know that Edmund G. Brown, the former governor of California back in the 60s, actually, has holdings and ties with Royal Dutch Shell that he developed after Sukarno was overthrown.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is all about money. And as I learned, as I said, I began all of this story in Watergate. One thing you learn is, you know, the old saw, follow the money. What I started to do, aside from the corporate finances, which are considerable, and the scandals concerning them are considerable, I was also following the expatriated Nazi money as well, and the Japanese funds as well. So you have an enormous amount of money that was being moved around the world, especially in gold, gold bars and gold currencies of various kinds, that was being moved like chess pieces all over the world. The first thing that had to be done in 1944, when the handwriting was on the wall in Europe, the Germans began to ship out as much as they possibly could. A lot of this went by U-boat, and a lot of it wound up in Asia. What a lot of people don't know is that Nazi Germany had a large U-boat traffic with Asia, with the Japanese in Asia. They were sending U-boats back and forth. We usually think of U-boats in the North Atlantic or something. But these were U-boats that were fitted out as container ships, basically. They would refuel in the Indian Ocean, and then they would continue on their way to Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, where they would buy raw materials they needed for their war effort. They would trade with the Japanese. But at the very end, in 44, late 44, early 45, these U-boats were now transferring gold bullion. They were transferring raw materials to help the Japanese fight their war, including technology to help the Japanese develop an atomic weapon. So all of this was taking place. They were moving personnel. They were moving documents. They were moving prototype machinery and all that kind of stuff over to the Japanese. We intercepted one of their U-boats, which had a lot of atomic energy-related equipment on board. The Japanese, had they managed to survive maybe another year fighting in the Pacific, might actually have developed the atomic bomb themselves. They were already working on the missile delivery systems, which the Nazis had perfected enough that the rockets they were developing could have delivered an atomic bomb. So we came very close to a complete different world than we have today.
Well, one of the things that has developed, of course, is the relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood and Adolf Hitler. And, of course, with the radical Islam that's going on right now. And you have a very good understanding of how the Catholic Church, Adolf Hitler, and the Muslim Brotherhood have basically worked together for quite some time.
Yeah, I talk about this a lot in Hitler Legacy because that's one of the things that astonished me as well. This idea of a global jihad is something that's fascinated me from the beginning because I didn't find really much evidence of it in the old days. There was jihad. There was holy wars of various kinds that ever since the time of the Prophet. I mean, he was running around, you know, conquering territory and converting people and all the rest of it. But this idea that you could call for a generalized jihad or a holy war among all Muslims anywhere in the world against everyone else was a kind of a new concept. And that really started not with the Muslims themselves. It started with a German archaeologist around the time of World War I, a guy called Max von Oppenheim. He was a kind of an Orientalist. He hung out in Egypt. He studied Arabic. He studied Islam. He had a number of wives. He lived in Cairo near the university, Al-Azhar University. And he was considered like the Germans' pet Islamicist. He was a guy who really understood Islam. So he told the Kaiser, look, you're going to form an alliance with Turkey, and it's going to be an alliance against Russia, against Britain and France. The best thing to do to help you guys out in North Africa and the Middle East, because the Brits were already in Egypt, the Italians were already in Libya. He said the best thing to do would be to have the Sultan of Turkey, which was the Ottoman Empire, the head of the Ottoman Empire, to declare a global jihad, a general jihad of all Muslims to rise up against the Russians, the British, and the French. And so the Kaiser said, damn, that sounds like a good idea. So he went and convinced the Sultan to do this. And the Sultan and his religious leader in Turkey did. They issued a fatwa, and they called for global jihad, the first ever global jihad. Well, that didn't work very well. A lot of the Muslims living in the Ottoman Empire hated the Turks, and they were not going to listen to anything the Turks had to say. Some were cutting deals with the Brits. Some were cutting deals here and there as they could. We know from the movie Lawrence of Arabia what happened, right? The British basically took over Damascus. They had betrayed the Arab revolt. They had promised the Arab leaders certain things they really weren't going to give them. They just wanted to win the war. And when the dust settled, suddenly there was Palestine. There was the British mandate in Palestine. And there was a guy called al-Husseini. And al-Husseini was the chief religious leader of Palestine, the Palestinian community. He was called the Grand Mufti of Palestine. And here was a guy who was extremely angry over the fact that suddenly Palestine had been given over to the West. It was part of a deal that the British had made. And now there was no Islamic homeland in Palestine. It was a British colony. And so he began to agitate against the British during the 1920s and the 1930s. When World War II started to break out, when Hitler came to power, al-Husseini thought, this is a guy I can work with. He's just as anti-Semitic as I am, and he has a much bigger army. He hates the British the way I do. We can work together. And eventually he convinced the Nazis, particularly Himmler, that he could perform a great service for the Third Reich by broadcasting in Arabic back to the Middle East, telling everybody to rise up against the British, to rise up against the foreigners, and to support Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party. So this was the beginning. This is a very complicated situation because it's political. It's not only religious, it's religious and political, and economic to a large extent. And the Muslim Brotherhood was starting up in Egypt. They were making alliances this way with the Grand Mufti. Adolf Eichmann actually traveled to the Middle East before the war actually broke out, trying to broker deals with al-Husseini and everybody else in the Middle East. Adolf Eichmann was considered to be their expert on Middle Eastern affairs. He spoke some Arabic. He spoke Yiddish. He was someone they considered would be the best person to have as an intelligence operative to try to cut some deals with the Arab states there. Saddam Hussein came from that background. Yasser Arafat came from that background. And finally, when the war was over and the Germans had lost, who do we find? We find a resurgence of Nazis winding up in Cairo. Nazi scientists, Nazi commandos, Otto Skorzeny, Hitler's favorite commando, and they're training Palestinian guerrillas to go and attack Israel. At the same time, their scientists are helping the Egyptians develop rockets and missiles to use to attack Israel as well. So in the 1950s, when Nasser was in charge of Egypt, the country was replete with Nazis. They had simply moved their operations from Europe to the Middle East.
Well, that brings up another question about Operation Paperclip and the influence of Nazis here in the United States, which is much bigger than perhaps people understand today.
Well, that's the funny thing. You know, when Paperclip was first announced, let's say, when news of it first hit the press in this country in the late 1940s, the idea was, well, it's only a handful of Nazi scientists we're bringing over. Then the handful became, well, it's about 100, maybe 200. Now we know it was way over 1,000. We brought thousands of Nazi scientists to the United States. We denazified them. Wernher von Braun was a major in the SS. You know, Walter Dornberger was a general. They all had SS involvement. They were all involved in the death camps, in using slave labor, all the rest of it. But we whitewashed their files. We brought them over to help jumpstart our space program, which in those days was part of the military. There was no NASA. Yeah, it was all a U.S. military program to develop missiles. So we brought over Nazis for doing that. We brought over a large contingent of Nazi scientists who specialized in medicine, aviation medicine. They went to Randolph Air Force Base in Texas, where there's an aviation medicine institute down there that initially was named after a Nazi until the local people rose up in protest and they had to take the name off the building. That was Hubertus Strughold, who was the in charge of aviation medicine. Why is that a problem? He used to practice, do experiments on living human beings in the camps to see if they could withstand extremes of cold and heat, to see if they could withstand low pressure conditions in upper atmosphere. All this stuff was done, photographed, recorded. Basically, it was torture of living human beings. These are the guys we brought over to help us. Now, if we were doing that, and the Catholic Church was doing that, it was basically a general attitude of, we're on their side, the Nazis are on our side. You know, we have some good Nazis, they work for us, you know. And we're going to use them to fight the Soviet Union, to fight the communists. This is the problem that I have with this. We negotiated, we bartered our morality for this. We essentially bartered our soul. We didn't need these guys, let's face it. We didn't need the Nazis. We had their documentation. We had prototypes of the V1s and the V2s. We had copies of a lot of the secret weapon stuff that they were working on. Yeah, it facilitated things to have the Nazis working for us. But in the end, you know, it wasn't worth it. In the end, we got besmirched with all of this. We helped Klaus Barbie escape. We turned a blind eye to a lot of the other Nazis who escaped. We knew who they were, and we knew where they were going. We just didn't care. The same office in Austria, in Salzburg, that had created the operation to find Nazis wherever they were, the war criminals, and prosecute them, the same office and the same personnel, by as early as 1946, were told, okay, forget it. Don't hunt the Nazis to prosecute them. Hunt them to hire them. And that was the beginning of the rat lines and all the rest of it that came out of the monastery roots. Everything came out of there. We made a decision right after the end of World War II to get into bed with the Nazis against the Soviets. And that opened a whole can of worms.
And the whole can of worms is happening right in front of us. I guess one of the questions has to be the influence, going back to Indonesia now, looking at our President Barack Hussein Obama, enormous Indonesian influence in his life.
Well, sure. Obama lived in an area that I know, in Jakarta. In fact, they have a statue of him in the school where he used to go there. There's a lot of stuff about this. I mean, his mother was part of the Ford Foundation. We don't know exactly the degree to which she might have been involved in intelligence gathering in some capacity for the U.S. government. We don't know. His stepfather in Indonesia is a very interesting guy. Even according to Obama himself, he used to sleep with a gun under his pillow. This was during the time when there was tremendous political upheaval there. We really don't know which side this guy was on. Was he a pro-Sukarno kind of guy? Was he a pro-Suharto kind of guy? You know, what was the deal here? The problem is we just don't know. We don't have enough information. And I've talked to a lot of people there. The whole Obama thing is very popular in Indonesia, or it used to be, until lately, where in Indonesia they're having second thoughts about, you know, an Obama presidency. But for the most part, they were very happy that they had, you know, an American president who used to live in Indonesia. And I've heard Obama speak the Indonesian language a couple of times, not personally, but I heard it on recordings. And he speaks pretty well. You know, he hasn't really lost his knowledge of the language or his knowledge of the culture. So I don't know what that connection is. You know, we can speculate a lot about it, but he was just a kid, let's face it, when he was living in Indonesia. He wasn't exactly, you know, James Bond at the moment. but that connection, though, is important, something that we need to know more about. I would love to know more about it myself. I've read a lot of stuff on the internet. A lot of it is speculative, and a lot of it is, you know, there's a lot of noise on there. You know me, I'm a guy who loves documents.
And
you know, I like to rely on, you know, hard sources. So I'm still at that story.
Now, are you familiar with the Subud cult?
Sure.
Absolutely. And his last name being Sorobaka,
yeah,
which is a Subud name.
Yes.
And the works of Dr. Jason Kistner at California State University, Fresno.
That I'm not aware of. I'm aware of Subud very well, but Kistner, I'm not sure.
Do you have any comments about the Subud cult? Because we're finding out that people like Bo Bergdahl is a Subud.
Yeah. It was one of these New Age things that started up a long time ago. There's a Subud office in New York City that I know. There's another one, I think, out on the West Coast. They're kind of, how shall I put it? They're New Age, and they're kind of vague in a lot of things. I've been finding people as members of Subud that I never suspected were members. So it's kind of a, it's It's the Indonesian version, you might say, of how the Chinese use something called the Confucius Society, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're aware, if you're familiar with that, but the Chinese government has been financing Confucius societies in a lot of universities
right.
around the country. There's little doubt about, you know, what the purpose of that is. Is it a, you know, is it a brainwashing kind of a psychological or propaganda operation? We don't know. But Subud seems to be kind of the same way. It's like a warm and fuzzy Indonesian cult. You know? So, yeah, I find it a little mysterious. Sure.
Islamic related?
Yeah, to an extent, but Islam in Indonesia is not the same as Islam in Syria and Iraq, for instance.
Sure.
It's a different kind of Islam. It's a bit more mellow, and it incorporates a lot of local religious and mystical things that traditional Islamic, traditional Muslims would hate, would consider blasphemous. So it's not really like a doctrinaire, you know, Muslim Brotherhood kind of Islam. It's the Indonesian version, which is a whole different ball of wax.
Well, we're coming up to the end of the hour, and I want to thank you for being on the show. I wanted to kind of get a little bit into your book about Mormonism, which I think is quite fascinating. I haven't read that, but I've read notations from it. Because at the time when I was first introduced to you, you're writing the book, or you had mentioned that you're writing the book when you're in Indonesia and you discovered information about the whereabouts of Adolf Hitler. How'd that book turn out?
Well, this is the problem. I was talking to somebody who had all the documentation. I saw the documentation. It's genuine. I saw passports. I saw a lot of stuff that I wished I could have used, but I had a legal problem in getting access to it and using it. So basically what I had to do was write around it, write around the information that I came across. But I can tell you personally, I spent 6 months in Southeast Asia about 2 years ago doing the research on this. I was away for quite a long time. And was able to justify to myself, especially through interviews with other people and discussions on the phone, that there is a very good chance that there's the man that went to Indonesia after Argentina and wound up there was definitely an Austrian, definitely a dead ringer for Hitler in his early days, definitely was not a medical doctor, as everyone seems to agree now. And I spoke with a lady not too long ago who tracked me down and called me on the phone, who was a member of the extended family around this guy when they lived in Austria. And she was able to confirm a number of issues for me as well. So I can't say exactly, I cannot say definitively that this man was Adolf Hitler. But if he was not, he was a high-ranking Nazi who felt he had to go to Indonesia to escape. He was not safe anywhere else in the world, according to his own words. And at one point, he wound up in Surabaya, that same Surabaya where we talked about Walter Havel, went to Hitler's friend. He went to Surabaya and died there. He was going to have a meeting with someone. A European man was meeting him at a hotel in Surabaya. This man never made it back from that meeting. He died in Surabaya, and I visited the grave in the cemetery in Surabaya, Indonesia, which is also extremely bizarre because there was no birth date or death date on that headstone, which for an Islamic cemetery is virtually unheard of. So there was some mystery about this man, who he really was, what his real identity was, and why did he go for the first time, leave his island, the safety of his island, go up to Surabaya, and then drop dead. So there's a lot of mystery about this story, and I'm still following it up to this day.
Wow. Well, listen, Peter, thank you very much for being on Agenda 21 Radio. We definitely have to have you back because, you know, really the world is kind of changing, and it's changing along the lines that perhaps maybe the Fourth Reich would, I guess we could call it that, the Fourth Reich would enjoy. There's no question about that. You see so many alliances that are being built and developed, and some of the same methodology, ideology that's that was right out of the Third Reich.
Absolutely, yes.
So, listen, thank you very much for being on Agenda 21 Radio. And like I said, we'll definitely be in touch.
My pleasure.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to Agenda 21 Radio. And Peter Lavenda, of course, being our guest here on Agenda 21 Radio. Really appreciate Peter being with us, and we wish the best for Peter and everybody else. So listen, stay tuned.
We're sending out an SOS to the last vestiges of freedom, democracy, and the American way of life. Paul Preston with Agenda 21.
Stay tuned for more of Paul Preston's Agenda 21 Radio.
This is AENN, American Exceptionalism News Network. This is AENN, American Exceptionalism News Network.